Yes, you do.
Good afternoon. It is approximately 1:34 p.m. on Wednesday, February 21st, and I'll call House Finance Committee to order. President Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Representative Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Grin, and Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Seaton. Before we start, remind everybody about their cell phones, and today we will introduce a committee substitute for House Bill 321, the supplemental bill. We'll then move to a second hearing on amendments on HB 176, ground emergency medical transport payments. Our last bill up today is HB 96, taxes, deductions, fees, and tax stamp discount. It's my plan to hear public testimony on HB 96 today. First bill we will deal with is HB 321. And so we have a committee substitute for House Bill 321 before us. Co-Chair Foster, can I have a motion to bring the committee substitute for 321?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the committee substitute for HB 321 Finance version 30-GH2781/0 for Oscar as the committee's working draft.
Object. And I have an objection from Representative Wilson for, so I will bring my staff and David Teal, Director of Ledge Finance, to the table. And you can put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation on the bill. The proposed committee substitute.
For the record, my name is Joan Brown. I'm staff to Chair Seaton.
And David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division.
So the administration included supplemental requests in their budget bills that were released on December 15th. The administration's standalone supplemental bill was introduced as House Bill 321 on January 31st. OMB described the December 15th supplementals when they presented their budget overview before the committee on January 18th, the supplemental bill requests on February 1st, and then they went through the supplemental budget amendments last Friday, February 16th. The four finance co-chairs, with the assistance of the Legislative Finance Division, have been analyzing the supplemental requests with the goal of having a fast-track supplemental bill. It's been several years since a fast-track supplemental bill has been adopted, but it used to be the norm. There are a couple of reasons why earlier passage of at least some of the supplementals are a good idea. The first is that agencies requesting the supplementals know their final current fiscal year budgets in a more timely fashion, alleviating uncertainty for the program managers and for the people that benefit from the programs. Shortening the lists of supplementals that ultimately get added to the capital budget bill at the end of a legislative session or a special session reduces the size of the actual capital budget bill, making it easier to track the items that are in the bill. When many items are going between bills and between bodies, items get dropped. That happened last year. One of the supplementals that you'll see in the bill, it's on line 21 on the legal side spreadsheet, adds or restores a supplemental that was inadvertently dropped last year. The fast track supplemental bill eliminates 9 pages out of the capital budget bill. This allows legal services to get a bill out more quickly. Requests that didn't make it into the fast-track supplemental bill just mean that at least one finance co-chair had a concern or a question that was not answered fully or timely. Any remaining supplemental requests will be considered for inclusion in the capital budget bill. Tomorrow, the other finance committee is also introducing an identical version of the fast-track supplemental bill. So in addition to the O version of the bill, you have before you a series of reports. There's a legal size spreadsheet of all of the supplemental requests. The lines that are shaded green in column 1 are included in the bill. So all of the items on pages 1 through 7.5 are included. You'll find the supplemental bill total on page 6 of the spreadsheet. It's $49.5 million of unrestricted general funds, $5.1 million of designated general funds, and $13.1 million of other funds for a total of $67.7 million. The remaining page and a half that are shaded green are the accounting system ratifications for prior years, which don't add to the bill total. The second column on the legal size spreadsheet is titled Bill, and it shows in which bill the supplementals were originally requested, whether it was the capital bill, the operating bill, or the supplemental bill. The middle columns of the spreadsheet from department through fund source are unchanged from the OMB version of the spreadsheet. On the right side of the spreadsheet, the yellow highlighted modification column notes what, if any, changes the Finance Committee co-chairs made to the original requests. For example, on lines 2 through 4, these items are now in the numbers section instead of in the language section. On line 8 of the spreadsheet, there's a new supplemental request from the legislature for $121,300 of general fund program receipts related to the extension of the Anchorage Wells Fargo lease in the Benson building. There are a variety of other changes noted in this column as well. On the far right side of the spreadsheet, the yellow highlighted legislative finance or LFD notes column just has some explanatory notes, such as whether this is a common supplemental request, any additional facts. So you also have a three-page legislative finance operating supplemental report with red boxes on it. The boxes by the transaction correspond to the line number on the legal spreadsheet. You also have a multi-agency or multi-year agency summary report that shows the fast-track supplementals by agency and whether they're capital or operating. There's only one capital request included in this version of House Bill 321. It's an $8.1 million statutory designated program receipt Volkswagen settlement that's appropriated to the Alaska Energy Authority. It's described on line 14 of the larger spreadsheet. Let's see, what else do we have here? The last report you have is a multi-year statewide total report that shows the fast track supplementals by line item, and again whether they're operating or capital. So, Mr. Chair, that's the end of my remarks. I think Mr. Teal may wish to add.
Maybe we should just wait for questions, Mr. Chairman, on that. I may have comments later, but they may just come up as questions. So.
Thank you. Are there questions from the fast-track supplemental representative Brooke? And before we go to that, I want to recognize that Representative Al Coffey and Gettenberg joined us earlier in the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just wanted to make sure that I understood the notes made under modification for line 18, which is related to the deposit from the CB or PCE fund and for the community assistance. The modification highlights that the fund source changes from PCE endowment to the Alaska Comprehensive Healthcare Fund. So are we switching from this $30 million from PCE to the healthcare fund? I'm trying to understand that note in modification.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, that's exactly what's happening. You may recall in our earlier discussions of the governor's original budget, which funded PCE in 18, community assistance from the PCE fund in 18. that would have made the FY19 distribution known, but it didn't do anything to help communities know what their FY20 distribution is so that they could prepare their community budgets early. What's happened in the supplemental is we're changing the fund source, not using the PCE fund, but instead using the reinsurance money that's coming back in, and I think, I don't know what line that's on in this, but it's a $25 million refund to the Achi fund. It is 13. So there's a somewhere between $80 million and $93 million available from that fund, the Achi fund or reinsurance fund, if it's less confusing. And the purpose in doing that is to allow the PCE earnings to be used in FY19. That occurs in the regular operating budget, but of course you can't see that yet. And that puts the PCE earnings used for community assistance on the track the legislature intended, that it was pre-funding community assistance rather than going through the supplemental process. So we had a skipped year, wanted to fund the $30 million FY18 appropriation so that we could save the $30 million from the PCE fund for 19. And this was just a fund source that kind of fell into everyone's lap in the last month or so. And because it's a supplemental and theoretically a one-time source, it seemed like a good idea to use one-time money, part of this reinsurance overpayment, for the purpose of funding community assistance.
Yeah, thank you. So, all right, thank you. I appreciate that. What I want to make sure that I understand in terms of the fund, and of course reading on here that it earned $112 million last year, and I know there's a formula that allows for how much will be spun off, and of course then there was legislation a couple of years ago that highlighted that what was above and beyond what was needed for PCE could go for community assistance. How does this change affect the overall value of the fund and those two calculations there?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's the purpose of funding it from the reinsurance fund, is so that we leave the PCE fund value unaffected. It would have been possible, since the earnings were so high, to fund both 18 and 19 community assistance from PCE earnings. That would reduce the value of the fund and reduce future earnings. So, again, it was a possibility, but one that wasn't favored by the co-chairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on lines 3 and 4, the additions to the Department of Corrections, it talks about the way the trend's going, but the trend right now is pretty stable. It's not going down as excessively as they thought it was, but it's not going up, you know, as well. So is there a better breakdown of exactly what we did in SB 91 to the population management that's been given, and then how, based on what, are we going to redisperse monies into those specific institutions?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't have that breakdown with me, but I'm sure we can get that from the department.
Thank you. A follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you very much. And on line 4, what we were unable to find out in subcommittee was really where the move was on the health needs, whether or not I know that the department did send several inmates out of state because of health needs that were more affordable, and they were looking at others. We got a list of those types of procedures that cost a lot, but no real, you know, trend of finding out whether or not we're talking about that this $10 million is more on just routine type of costs that come, or whether or not more people are needing dialysis or cancer treatment, or exactly where this $10 million is going, and whether or not we would be seeing some of these inmates leaving because they completed their prison sentence, or whether or not we're talking about long-term and some of those may be going 10 or 15 years and we'll be responsible for a long time because this $10 million may be growing a lot more without some type of change. So just a little bit more detail why that $10 million is we're looking at not just a supplemental, but it's also that same increase in the 20 in the 19. Thank you very much, and I also remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and I'll go ahead and check so we get to the discussion. Representative Ortiz, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, we go to line page 5, line 20. I know this in support of this particular transaction, but can you remind me as to what necessitates this? Page 5, line 20.
Through the chair, you're referring to the $23 million appropriation of the Marine Highway System, and that supplemental was requested because last legislative session there was some movement of money, a reduction in general funds that was supposed to be offset by additional spending from the Marine Highway System Fund that would be allowed because of a deposit, a supplemental deposit into the fund in the prior year. That deposit occurred, but at a much lower amount than was anticipated. So the Marine Highway Fund ended up 23 and change short, 20, almost 24 million short. Shorter than anticipated. They can't schedule without that money. They can't. That's probably a primary reason for having a fast track supplemental, is to make sure that the Marine Highway System knows that it can operate boats as scheduled.
Are there further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I'm late. I actually, a couple of these things have shot out at me. On page 5, line 22, even though there's no monetary funds, do we still have to ratify this? Is that what this is about?
Yes.
Okay.
Through the chair.
Thank you. On page 8, line 37, in the commerce budget, we had the other position, which it mentions. Was there a reason the second position wasn't added with the first one? I mean, obviously there was, but I'm just wondering what it was.
Which line are you talking about?
Line 37.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't recall what the specific issue was, but just that there was an issue, and so that's why line 37 is not included in the bill.
Okay. And I knew this was coming, line or page 13. The change in the appropriations between the Gas Line Development Corporation and AGDCA Key LNG. Could you go through that? I mean, I know we're doing it in the budget, but is this the authorization, or is it the other way around?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, if the item is not shaded green in column 1, it's not in the bill. So that's a supplemental item for a future decision.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's what I get for being late.
Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adoption of the CF 30GH2781/? Seeing no further objection, we will adopt the working draft for House Bill 321 30GH2781/. So thank you, and we'll take just a brief leave while I pass the gavel over to the other group.
back on record, 1:54 p.m. Our next bill up today will be HB 176, which is Ground Emergency Medical Transport Payments by Representative Wolf. And we last heard this bill on February 16th, and at that meeting we concluded public testimony, and there are two amendments to this bill that I will offer up for the sponsor. And at this time, I'd like to ask Representative Wool and his aide, Mr. Rob Earl, to please come up to the table. And if you could put yourselves on the record, and just a reminder, since we have two male members, just identify yourself for the record prior to speaking. And so with that, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. My name is Adam Wool. I represent District 5 in Fairbanks. And with me is...
For the record, Rob Earl, staff to Representative Wool.
Please begin.
Mr. Chairman, if you please, I could go over the flow chart. First of all, the left and the right circle, blue circles, are both DHSS. Sorry, I didn't label that as such. So if we start at the provider circle, these will be municipalities, fire departments, possibly tribal organizations. If, for example, someone breaks a leg and a provider provides an ambulance transport with a total cost of $1,000, through regular state Medicaid, they hypothetically, you get a $400 reimbursement, leaving a $600 uncompensated cost. That is how it's happening now. Then heading to the right of the provider circle, this is the supplemental reimbursement program as proposed by HB 176. The provider would transmit to the department the non-federal share, which is 50% of the uncompensated costs, plus, in this example, as you can see by the box below, the department is charging a 20% administrative fee. As the bill is written now, it is up to a 20% administrative fee. So that would be an extra $60 on the non-federal share for a. So the provider would be transferring a total of $360 to the department, and then the department would submit that billing to federal Medicaid, and federal Medicaid would send $360 back to the department. Now notice that the green arrow does not say 720, it says 600. That is explained in the 20% administrative fee box. You can see that in the legislation on page 2, lines 3 through 7, the provider is not allowed to receive more than the total cost of transport in total reimbursements. So under this scenario, the state would have to keep the $120 and send the $600 back to the provider. Let's just look for a second what the provider is recouping under this scenario. They have the original $400, and then they're getting $600 back from the department, but $360 of that was their own money. So they've recouped $240 plus the $600 for a total of $640 out of the $1,000. Dollar total cost. I'm sure there's questions.
Does the Finance Committee have any questions? Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you. I'm sorry, are we talking about amendment number one?
No, we're just talking about
it. Just the flow chart first? Oh. I guess I have a question about the administrative fee and how that operates and why it's set at 20%. That seems pretty high for an administrative fee. And then who actually gets that in the end, I guess, is my question.
To the chair, Representative Kawasaki. So the 20% administrative fee is much more than the actual cost. This is a unique opportunity under this legislation that it's allowed by federal rules. Other states are charging an even greater amount. So under this scenario, the administrative fee is it's being sent from the provider to the department, and then it's matched by the feds, so the department is ending up with twice the administrative fee under this scenario.
So through the chair, I guess why don't we just allow the administrative fee to be even higher than that?
Through the chairperson of Kawasaki, at some point it comes down to what we think the federal CMS will allow in the state plan amendment with the negotiations between the department and the and CMS. And we think they would allow language that says up to 20%, and you go more than that and maybe not. Maybe they wouldn't allow it.
And then
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the reason why the administrative fee is set at 20%, is that linked to the regular price tag of a regular, say, ambulance fee? I mean, or what CMS would normally pay for an ambulance ride? And because Alaska's prices tend to be a little bit higher, is there any nexus between those two numbers, those two values, the administrative fee and the total amount that can be received by CMS?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I would say no. I don't think there's a link there. I don't want to say the 20% is arbitrary, but it's kind of what we decided would be allowable, would probably be allowable. And I believe at the last hearing, Director Brody testified that the actual administrative cost would be 0.26%, roughly.
So, through the chair, if the actual cost of administrative fee is 2.6%, I guess we're just getting more money from the federal government by saying that we want 20%.
Representative Wolt.
Through the chair, this is Representative Wolt. Representative Kawasaki, I think that's basically the cost, that the admin cost of processing this money is not 20%. It's quite a bit less. But as the consultants who have done this in many other states have told us, that 20% is a very standard fee, and some are up to as high as 27. So we just thought that 20% was a median number that we could ask for and get without having a problem with the feds. And this extra money could come into the Department of Health and Social Services and be utilized for other things and relieve pressure on the UGF that we currently are providing them. So in our current fiscal situation, we figured we shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth.
And one final. And then one final question through the chair is that if the state were to get 20% and the federal government, CMS, would pay that 20% on top of the whatever the extra, the $360, I guess, in this example, how much of that would go to the provider that is doing the transportation?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, if I understand you correctly, in this scenario, neither the original administrative 20% or the matched 20% goes back to the provider.
And
Representative Kawasaki?
So even if the cost of, again, an ambulance run is more expensive than the amount they would get, they wouldn't necessarily get any more of that revenue back. It would go to the state, and the state would not release that to the city or
to the chairperson of Kawasaki. I'm not sure I understand your question.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I Representative Kawasaki, I think what you're trying to ask is if Alaska has higher rates for ambulance and first of all, we can get reimbursed up to the cost. There's no upper limit. The reimbursement for the administrative costs in this scenario does not go back to the provider. It stays with the state, which is a good segue into our amendments, because one of the amendments addresses that so that the provider in his initial billing to the state Medicaid for their costs, they can add that 20% of the non-reimbursed share, they can add that to their overall bill so that they will be reimbursed that $60 in this case. So, and we're happy to go into those amendments at any time you want.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Just FYI, we do have available for questions Health and Social Services Director Margaret Brody in the room in the back here. I see we've got Juno Fire Chief Rich Etheridge. Do we have any further questions of the committee before we go into amendments? Representative Wool? Oh, I'm sorry. It was Representative Tilton and then Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Wilson.
I had talked previously to you, Robin, and come to your office just about the administrative fees, and am concerned at setting a 20% fee as an administrative fee that we hold to be the number that we would pick. And I'm concerned about setting that as a precedent, because through the years, as I've been involved with the Health and Social Services, there has been lots of discussion on what administrative fees should be when it comes to different grant programs and things like that. I'm all for getting as much back as we can, but I do have a concern that we set a 20% as our administrative fee, and that we'll be held to that as we look at other grants and things going out. So I'm not sure how we can resolve that. But
through the chair, Representative Tilton, I understand what you're saying. I think in this case, with other states, the precedent was already set, and we're sort of mirroring what they're doing and taking advantage of the federal government's generosity. But our obligation to pay according to Title
Title 19 of the Social Security Act.
Title 19, thank you. But I would not like to see a 20% admin fee applied across the board to every state department, including HESS. So, and maybe the Margaret Brody, who's online, can talk to that a little more. And just to be clear, in this bill, it is up to 20%, so it's not a mandatory 20%.
I'd like to hear from Margaret if that'd be okay.
Ms. Brody, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Brody. I'm the Director of Healthcare Services for the State of Alaska. And we had conversations with CMS this morning, and the only amount that the state would be able to collect for an administrative fee are our actual costs of the one position.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? Representative Tilton?
And this is on another sure. question. And Rob, I think you probably already answered this to me, but I had another question earlier disregarding the continuation of this particular program, and if the federal government had decided that they were not going to continue to be able to fund that, they ran out of funds, what is the obligation of the state to continue the program?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Tilton, if you see on page 1, line 9 through 11, it says that the amount of supplemental reimbursement paid to a provider must equal the amount of federal financial participation. So if the federal financial participation goes away, the program will go away.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions? Seeing no further questions, we will move over to amendments. And we have two that were offered up by the sponsor. And so I will move those. I move amendment number 1. Are there any objections so that the sponsor can explain? We have an objection. Thank you. Mr. Earle.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This amendment really does three main things. First of all, you can see on line 9 and 10 that it sets the 20% as the fee as equal to 20% rather than up to. Secondly, on lines 10 through 12, it allows the provider to add the administrative fee to the cost of the medical transport. And maybe I can show you on the chart that in a minute. And thirdly, it separates out the IGT method, the intergovernmental transfer from the provider to the department, and the CPE, certified public expenditure methodology. This allows the department to be sure that they're the ones choosing which methodology and not the providers. So looking at the chart again, the flow chart, under this scenario, with the amendment, the provider would be allowed to add the $60 administration fee to the total cost, so that the total cost would now be $1,060. So then when the transfer comes, you know, the state is holding the 720, and under the original bill they can only transfer 600. They would now be able to transfer 660 back to the provider, because in the box down here we can see that this math in the last sentence is written as if the total cost was 1,000, but if the total cost is 1,060, the department is able to receive that extra $60 and not go over the total cost prohibition, which is in the bill on page 2, lines 3 through 7, subsection B there. I'm not sure that's clear, but if anybody has any questions.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have a question on the child charge and administrative fee. First of all, who's charging it? Because I can't tell whether it's the department or the person who had the ambulance fee. And why are we telling them what they have to charge?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, it would definitely be the department charging the provider that administrative fee. And I don't know what the answer is.
Through the Chair, this Representative Wilson, we have an amendment to this amendment, which will change it to the administrative fee must be equal to 20% to the administrative fee can be up to 20%. So we're not locking the 20% into law, but that it can be up to 20%. And then we do this is a charge from the department to the CMS.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up?
I don't see the amendment he's talking about.
Representative Wilson, Representative Seaton has the amendment to the amendments. So with that, maybe let's go ahead and move the amendment to the amendments. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 1, and that would, on lines 9 through 10, delete must be equal to and insert may not exceed. So again, on lines 9 and 10, delete must be equal to, and we would then insert may not exceed.
And the motion has been made. Is there an objection to the conceptual amendment? Seeing no objection, the conceptual amendment to amendment number 1 is adopted. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It makes it a little closer, a little clearer. So I just have a question for Margaret Brody. Ms. Brody, could you speak a little bit more about the administrative fee? I mean, is that something where, again, you can only charge, you know, the amount that you actually utilize, as you said, with the one position? Or is this program a little bit different where if the department wanted to charge up to 20%, even though you didn't have those costs to the federal government, this program would allow it?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, the federal government would not allow us to charge any more than our actual costs. So we would make our best estimate on what the total cost would be and divide that by the cost of the position divided by two, and that would be the percentage that we would start charging at the beginning of the fiscal year. We may have to amend it a tiny bit as time goes on, maybe higher it, maybe lower it, but we would have to keep track of it throughout the fiscal year.
Mr. Chairman.
All of Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Ms. Brody. That really helps. And so on the other side, the department or the municipality who has the ambulance service, is that the same thing, is that they can only charge to the department their actual administrative fees as well?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, they can only charge the actual cost of providing the service, and that may incur some administrative fees.
And one more follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so I believe it's this amendment. What this amendment would do would then, before, if they had administrative fees, the municipality, they were not going to be allowed to recoup that. This amendment will now allow them to recoup their actual administrative costs as well as the fees to the service.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, as long as they are not claiming those administrative fees for any other program.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki?
I just got my question answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions on amendment number one? Seeing no further questions, is the objection maintained?
Remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
The objection has been removed. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, amendment number one has been adopted as amended with conceptual amendments number one. And so with that, let's move over to amendment number two, and I will move amendment number two. We have an objection, Mr. Earle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rob Earle. Amendment number two, first of all, there was the concern that by adding air to this legislation that CMS might deny the entire program. This amendment separates out ground, water, or air, so that if air is rejected by federal Medicaid, then the ground portion of the legislation could continue. And then it deletes all the conditional effect language on page two and just inserts an immediate effective date.
Representative Wilson?
Can you explain that again?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. So as the bill is currently written, there was concern that since air is included in the current bill, even though the short title still has ground in it, air is included in the current version O, there was concern that the during the negotiations between the department and federal Medicaid might deny air, the air portion. And the way this is written now, if you go to page three, the section two, the commissioner has to basically, if CMS doesn't approve all the provisions in the program, then the bill doesn't ever pass. So now it's separated out. There's that or, groundwater or air, and then it says, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, if they approve any one of those, any one of those types of emergency medical transportation services, they can move forward with that type.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions on amendment number two? Seeing none, is the objection to amendment number two maintained?
I remove my objection.
The objection has been removed. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, amendment number two is adopted, and it is amendment number two to 30-LS07505/O.5. And so with that, are there any further amendments come before the committee? Seeing none. We are going to go ahead and hold this bill for an updated fiscal note, and we will bring the bill back up under bills previously heard. So with that, Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Seaton?
Mr. Chair, just under discussion with further information to bring back, I'd like to get a little more analysis on how this is applied in the other states, just to make sure that we are following the pretty universal application of this methodology of doing it, because it sounds like from the reports we had earlier, it's quite different, and we are not accepting federal money that other states are. So just want to make sure that when we come back, we have something laid out as to how that's being accomplished in the other states and not being accomplished here.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we'd be glad to do that because our consultant that's worked on many other states assures us that those states are getting 20% or 27%, and it may, you know, there's this IGT, intergovernmental transfer, and then a CPE, certified public expenditure, and those are the payment methods that the Department of Health and Social Services can receive payments from the federal government, and so those are different types of payments, and maybe that's where the sort of discrepancy we're hearing is coming from, but I know that other states are successfully doing it, so we'd be happy to follow up on that for the committee.
I've got a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, and we could get some clarification maybe from Ms. Brody, because I've heard different things. If this is new money, administrative charges on top of what we're already doing, or are we just getting reimbursed in a different manner and not being reimbursed the old way? And is the old way not less than the 20%? So we heard the other day this is new money administrative charges. Then I thought I heard we cannot be getting these if we're charging them already some other place. So are we displacing one set of money with another? So if Ms. Brody could answer that question, that'd be great.
Ms. Brody?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the way that this is done is there's actually two different payments. The initial billing would go straight through the Medicaid Management Information System, just like all the normal weekly bills. And then on the back end, we would have to, for the participating government entities, we would have to bill them the difference between what they claim is costs, and they're going to have to put their total costs on the claims and what we paid them, and then we would be billing them for that and the administrative fee. So they would actually get two payments, one, the allowable amount right up front, and then the second payment is a manual process where we have to calculate what they owe us, they would have to pay it, and then we would release that money back to them along with the federal share.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton?
So thank you. So is this the intergovernmental transfer methodology that you were describing, or is this the current methodology that we're using?
Ms. Brody?
Mr. Chair, that the current methodology is for the initial payment, and the second payment is this new methodology.
And
Representative Seaton?
Mr. Chairman, I just request that the sponsor of the bill, since they've been working with the consultant, get with our CMS and make sure that we're both working through all of the same system, and so that we fully understand what we're doing. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton, we will do that. And also, I just want members to remember that regardless of the administration fee, what we're trying to get is more reimbursement for the medical transport providers, because that's really what the bill is about.
Thank you, Representative Wool. And with that, we'll move to the next bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, our next bill up today is HB 96. It's taxes, deductions, fees, tax stamp discount. Here to present the bill is Representative Thompson and his senior policy advisor, Forrest Wolf.
No raise, no.
Representative Thompson and Mr. Wolf, if you could put yourselves on the record, just a reminder, if you could just identify yourself prior to speaking, just for transcription. And with that, if you could go ahead and jump right into your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you and the committee for hearing House Bill 96. House Bill 96 came about because several years ago we saw that we were having indirect expenditures. And an indirect expenditure is a state discount on something that, or a tax credit for something that the people are doing. Those were never tracked. They don't show up in a budget, and there's a lot of money involved. But we never did know how much or what it was all about. So we set it up to where the Treasury Department must make a report every 2 years showing how much money is foregone revenue that the state has had. They turn that over to Ledge Finance. They look through it and come up with a printed report to every legislator, and they will get that and take a look and know that some of the things we have in there, we actually put sunsets on. Now, some of those, the sunsets are going to run out. If it's a good one, maybe a legislator wants to maybe extend that sunset date. These didn't have sunset dates on them. This is to go back and try to recover some revenue that we forego because of tax credits and things like that. There's four of them in here, and it amounts to well over $350,000 that the state foregoes in revenue. These things are what we're trying to address. And there's other bills that are coming up forward on some other ones that have some sunset dates, and we'll address those hopefully in the near future. But this one has $350,000. That's over $350,000, and that's a pretty sizable amount of money. My staff, Forrest Wolf, is going to go through and give you the breakdown on what these four items are, and on the record.
excuse me. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Forrest Wolf, Senior Policy Advisor to Representative Steve Thompson, and we'd like to thank you all for hearing House Bill 96 today. HB 96 repeals or removes four minor indirect expenditures from state law, which should provide a modest amount of increased revenue for the state of Alaska. The first is it removes the deduction of federal taxes from calculating adjusted gross income when you're calculating the state tax collected on gambling aboard large cruise ships. The second is it repeals the provision allowing an investigation expense under the Alaska Small Loans Act to replace a fee required under the Alaska Business Licenses Act. Number three, it removes a 0.4% deduction from the tobacco tax for the expense of accounting and filing that return. And number four, repeals a discount on cigarette tax stamps intended to be compensation for physically affixing the tax stamps to the packages themselves. As mentioned earlier by Representative Thompson, according to the fiscal note provided by Department of Revenue, it's estimated that HB 96 will increase revenue by at least $339,500 in fiscal year 19, of which $219,150 would go to the unrestricted general fund. In this time of financial instability and economic hardship, the state needs to find increased revenue wherever it can, and HB 96 certainly helps in that endeavor. And we would appreciate your support. With us today to answer questions, I believe we have Ken Alper and Dan Stickle from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you. So I don't see Ken online either.
I believe he's in the building somewhere. He said he'd be here about 2:30.
Okay, and then Dan Stickle is here. Okay, great. Okay, with that, does the committee have any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a two-page bills related to indirect expenditures chart. you mentioned four different things that were covered in the, this is all, I'm only seeing three, maybe two of them are in one, but I just didn't follow it.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, or excuse me, Co-Chair Seaton, that's correct. These are just, this was a document that was released about a year ago, and as you can see, it has three of the components listed on here. I'm not sure if they just didn't have a reporting agency, reporting venue to collect information on the fourth one, but there are four that has been repealed.
Is there two separate ones in cigarettes?
Yes, there are two separate ones in cigarettes, yes.
Do we have any further questions? Seeing no further questions, we'll move over to public testimony, and I will open up public testimony on HB 96. And let's see with that. Is there anybody here in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none online, I believe we have a few people here. Let's see here. Looks like Gert Abbott. If you're online, if you could, calling in from the Ketchikan LAO, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. My name is Garrett Abbott. I'm here to speak in support of the tobacco tax portions of HB 96. Indian indirect subsidy for the sale of addictive carcinogenic products could only benefit our state. It would not only save a little money, but also potentially nudge up the cost of smoking, thereby, in a small way, helping reduce our state's long-term health care costs, albeit in a very small way. However, I also feel it necessary to point out that this sort of legislation cannot be a solution to Alaska's ongoing budget crisis. At most, a bill such as this only save a few hundred thousand dollars, which is a very trivial amount. Foregone revenue is no substitute for what we truly need, a broad-based progressive tax on income and capital gains, and I hope the Finance Committee won't spend too much time on such legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee? I'm seeing no questions. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else online who would like to testify? Seeing none, and there's nobody else in the room, so we will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 96. Just for those folks who may be watching on TV there, if you would like to submit written testimony, you can do so by sending that via email to housefinance@akleg.com. Again, that's housefinance, there are no spaces, @akleg.com. And so with that, we will go ahead and set the bill aside. We will set an amendment deadline, 5 p.m. on Friday, February 23, if folks could turn those into my aide, Ms. Jane Pearson. And so with that, it looks like we have come to the end of our agenda. Is there anything else to come for the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Thursday, February 22 at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting, we will hear a joint presentation with the House Resources Committee on China, LNG, and the Alaska Gas Pipeline by Dr. Wenren Yang, PhD. And we'll take public testimony on the supplemental bill, and we'll plan to move committee substitute for HB 321 finance from committee tomorrow, if that is the will of the committee. And then, if time allows, we'll also take up the first two subcommittee reports from the Judiciary and the Office of the Governor subcommittees. So with that, Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that the questions that we were able to put on, that we're going to get the responses before we try to move the supplemental. So
if we
hopefully we will.
We will definitely, yeah. My philosophy is not to rush things, and so I'd like to get the answers. And if we don't have good answers, we can always hold that off. So thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton.
And on some of the questions may have been more policy-related than numerical, so just raising that issue that those questions are there.
Okay, if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we will adjourn at 2:34 p.m. Thank you.